It's a great honor for me to be here today, and it's quite a intense and deep topic, because the Nahj in and of itself is just not an easy book to understand, and it's multi-layered, so you find that there's a lot of layers to that, there's a lot of interpretations and understanding to that. But I've had a very good time going through it and looking at some of the concepts. Much of it is interlinked. And an overriding theme that comes through, whether it's on a social level or a communal level or a family level, is essentially the idea of justice. And you looked at that last week. I'm going to develop on that then. But before I do, I think it's important for us to get some definitions as to what we're doing and how we're going to do them. Because again, as I said, most of this does overlap in terms of what the Emir says in how to move a community and a society forward. It's multi-layered, and there's a causality which is there. And I think one of the deep things that he brings forward is this reality of causality, that there is a metaphysical causal effect in the universe, and there's a physical causal effect in the universe. Thus, if you were to look at it in very simple terms, I would say that even Sharia has a multifaceted reality based upon three layers. One of them is the cosmic basis of that, and here we can call the Sharia in terms of the causal effects of the world. We have a cosmic relationship, an environmental relationship, and as we have environmental crises, you will then see that new fatwa will come forward in the next generation or so in terms of preservation of that. And in the same way, you have social laws or social principles, and then you have your internal principles, spirituality and the individual development of virtue. And you'll see all of this when we look at different concepts that come forward. So it's all interlinked, and one has a ramification on the other. So I think the first thing really to define is, what is society? Before we can even go into community and family, what is society? And you'll see that each one of these definitions are interlinked. So really, a society can be broken down into this. A society is really a group of people persisting on something which is known as social interaction. And that society can be based on three things. One is geographical or social territory. So to give you an example, we in England, we can regard us as one society. Now, societies are upon societies. London can be seen as a society. The UK can be seen as a federation of societies. The USA is a prime example of federations of states coming together. So a family unit, you go wider than that, becomes a community. You go wider than that, becomes a society. You go wider than that, becomes a state. In this way, when we talk about the concept of ummah, what is it? Ummah is anything and everything which brings together various different societies. You can expand that. You can go from a microcosm to a macrocosm. Anything bigger than the ummah would be the cosmos. The ummah can be just one city, or the ummah can be an entire nation. The entire Islamic empire could be regarded as an ummah. And it's possible our definitions will become blurred, specifically as globalization increases, and then we become one global ummah. More than possible, the term has been used. So that's one thing. So what we're seeing is that a state or society is essentially patterns. And this comes under sociology, it's patterns of people. Whether it's geographical, whether it's political, and again, politics is very important. Well, the third thing is cultural. And you'll see communities and families united on the basis of culture, first thing. Second definition then, which develops from this, is what is a culture? Because if a state or a society or a community, one of the components of which is culture that binds us together, what is the definition of culture? And here again, it's important, because culture is beliefs, morality, customs, or common law that binds us. And you find this specifically when the Imam talks about different communities, that he asks people to be vigilant and wary on the fact that there's variable cultures which are there. Now again, bearing in mind the context and bearing in mind that this book is for the end of times, what comes forward is that you have, on the one hand, you have beliefs, so a common belief which forms cultures, morality, customs, common law. But the one thing that we forget is art. Arts are also something which is extremely important when it comes to cultures. The Islamic civilization in and of itself is formed of seven cultures. It is not just one linear culture. There's seven cultures that form the Islamic civilization, or did form Islamic civilization. We don't have anything today known as Islamic civilization. But when we look at civilizations, when you look at Europe, there was a Judeo-Christian civilization which was there, and based upon Judeo-Christian principles, and that also, when it came to art and music, formed what is culture. Arts and music also form Islamic culture as well. And again, it's not a topic which talked about, but the older generation, the ulama, would do that. Sheikh Baha'i, for example, was an expert in music, has an entire bab on music. Mir Frendiski as well, Mir Damad. And he goes all the way back, for example, to the likes of Sheikh Dusi. There's extensive work being done. Yes, there's certain things halal and haram, we're not going to go into that. But the fact is that culture plays a huge part. And again, when you look at the words of the Imam, there's a movement towards understanding culture as well. He says specifically that learn languages, which is the ethos of this. Learn languages. Why? Because for every language that you learn, you are preserved from the shar of people. At the same time, you come close to those people. Culture also is defined by language. And you'll see that the seven major cultures within the Islamic world are broken down because of languages. Go to the far side, you have something which is known as Malay culture. Malay culture is completely different, for example, from subcontinental culture. So you find subcontinent as well, cultures united on one language. The most spoken language, Islamic language in the world is Urdu, for example. You can't get around that. You look at Pakistan, there's about 200 million people there. You look at India, it's just over 200 million people there. You look at, for example, Bangladesh. You look at Sri Lanka, the common language. Yes, they have multiple languages within that, but the common language that comes forward is one language. In the same way, you've got the Malay culture, Indonesia, Malaysia, two cultures there. Third culture, you've got the Persian culture. Persian culture starts from where? Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Iran, even parts of Pakistan come under the whole remit of Persian culture because they speak either Dari or Farsi, united because of that. Then the culture, what's the next one from that? If we go from the east to the west, then you have Arab culture. Now, Arab culture starts from the river Euphrates and ends on Bin Ghazi. That was defined as anything within that would be the culture and the customs of the Arabs. From Bin Ghazi, which is in Libya, all the way down to the Euphrates. That was what was regarded as Arab culture. Anything else far west from that wasn't. This is where Africa is divided into two, West African culture and East African culture. In the same way you have pockets of culture in Eastern Europe, Slovak or the Balkans. The Balkans were inherently Muslim once upon a time. And even now there's a revival of Islam which is going on. So in this way you have a huge culture. And there's another one which has not been identified but it's coming to light. It's Chinese culture. The western province of China, there's over 100 million Muslims who are there. That's a huge amount of people. No one Muslim country has 100 million other than if you go to Pakistan, you go to Indonesia. That's a huge amount of people. The 100 million people, that was the consensus about 50 years ago. How many Muslims there are today, we don't know. But the fact of the matter is that their culture is interblended, almost interlinked with the Chinese Confucianist culture. And so therefore you see a hybrid Islam which is coming forward. And this is why I feel that in this day and age, there will be a very much British or Western Islamic culture which is slowly defining itself. Why do I mention this and why is that important? Because of the fact that when you look at the Kalam of the Imam, it's almost as if he covers all of that. He's preparing his people for a time where there may be this much diversity, this much change. And so the principles and the morals he gives is actually nation building, estate building. Each one of those principles can be applied on a state. Each one of those principles can be applied on a community. Each one of those principles can be applied on a family basis. So really, if I was to finish off the definition of what culture is, it's a way of life, and as we said, customs, beliefs of a particular people in a particular time. Customs change. Culture changes over a period of time. Culture is not something which is stagnant. And remember one thing. Religion is beliefs, right? Religion is a belief which requires clothing. And the clothing which is given to a religion is through culture. This is why you find that every culture takes Islam for itself. And the best thing you see is when it comes to your azah, that every culture believes is this. Whether you're sitting in Karachi, whether you're sitting in Bombay or Mumbai, whether you're sitting in Tehran, whether you're sitting in Mazar-e-Sharif, whether you're sitting in Iraq somewhere, whether you're sitting in, for example, Aleppo or Damascus, whether you're sitting in Beirut, whether you're sitting in Dar es Salaam, whether you're sitting in London or otherwise. It's almost as if each one of those members, regardless of culture, regardless of race, feels it's theirs. So religion in and of itself is a belief that requires clothing. Many of our principles are like that. You're told to pray. You're told how to pray. But when it comes to the dress code, you're giving an abstract instruction to cover your body in a particular way. But what you wear, how you eat, all of these things, the juziyat, essentially, of your day-to-day living, Imam is allowed autonomy in terms of the culture. In terms of the principles are abstract and the principles are what Islam gives you. Why do the principles need to be abstract? Because we believe, as the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, that our religion is until the end of time. End of time means that if we don't have answers to every single question until the end of time, it devoids our religion. That's the open challenge. We have every single answer for everything until the end of time. If we don't do it, devoids our religion. How do we do that? Does the Imam give 1,000 volumes tackling every single question, or he doesn't do that? What is it? Sixth Imam answers this. He says, it's for us, it's to give you the principles, it's for you to extract from the principles answers. This is what we call our corpus of Usul al-Fiqh that we have today. It is far more extensive than the Sunni world because of the fact that we have ijtihad. Ijtihad is a tool which differs from ijtihad in the Sunni world, which is used as one of the masadir, as the sources of law. Ijtihad is not a source of law for us. Ijtihad is a tool. It is a tool to expound from the principles of the Quran and the words of the Imams, which essentially go back to the Prophet, how we should live and conduct ourselves. So you'll see there's going to be overlap in this. There'll be overlap in terms of Sharia, there'll be overlap in terms of what the Imam is saying. The next thing I want to define, third thing, is politics. Because communities, family, societies, each one of them have politics, right? What is politics, essentially? Again, let's look at definitions. If you look at politics, the best definition or the widest definition which we have goes back to Plato. Plato defines politics. Why is it that Plato defines politics? Because of the fact, again, that the words of the emir were unheard. Heed wasn't given to those words. You go back and you see when the second Khalifa goes to Alexandria, Sikandaria, and when he wants to demolish the libraries of Sikandaria, he comes to the Imam and he asks him, what should I do? Imam says, preserve all of this. There's knowledge in there which may not be for you now, but generations afterwards will come and they'll use that knowledge. You go back and you see what was in the libraries of Sikandaria. You had the Greek philosophy. From Greek philosophy, it goes even further back than that. Greek philosophy from the time of Pythagoras was a movement which you looked at mysticism of the Egyptians. Mysticism of the Egyptians. From that, you had the rational philosophies of the Greeks. You had the Pahlavi philosophy of Iran and the Sasanian philosophies of there. You had the Indus Valley and you had the mysticism of the Indus Valley. All of this knowledge was gathered together because this was perennial wisdom. This perennial wisdom goes back to Khidr alayhi salam. From that it goes back to Idris. The knowledge was there. What did the second Khalifa do? He didn't pay heed to what Imam was saying. He said, the Kitab of Allah is sufficient for us. Yes, the Kitab is sufficient for you, but do you understand the Kitab of Allah? It's layered. You know, the 70,000 meanings to one line of that. All of knowledge is found within that, right? All of knowledge is. If I was to ask you right now, Sunnah is also timeless, by the way. Does Rasulullah give a particular precedence as how we should travel in space? And you guys will say no. If that's the case, then the Quran and the Sunnah is null and void. It's not if it doesn't have the answers to that, because the Quran itself says, Tibyan li kulli shay. So what does it mean then? And there's an entire discussion within Islam to say that Sunnah is of twofold. One is the manifest Sunnah that you have, and one is the Sunnah which is found within Imam al-Mubin, who is the Imam of the time, and he manifests that. Everything, even up to time travel and space, everything that is going to be found is found there. But again, it's a seed, and the tree comes from the seed. This is why principle, and there is a tradition to say, in fact, that Amir al-Mu'mineen disappeared, and 7 days later he comes back. And people ask him where he went, and Rasulullah tells them that he was sent to another place. He disappeared. People think the hadith says that he disappeared in the ground and the munafiqeen were rejoicing that he didn't come back. Comes back many days later, appears all of a sudden. Where did you go? Went to a far place. Why there was a conflict there. And there's entire principles that are developed on that. So for example, his interaction with the jinn, his interaction with supernatural, his philosophical discourses, everything is there. Look, everything that we need, Islam has given. Then you can also, I mean, when you were in this place, how did you pray? How did you fight? Everything is there. Everything is there. It requires us to sit down and to develop it. This is why our doors of ijtihad are open, and this is why we are developing. This is why new things come into play. This is why atmic is circumstantial as well. Certain things are fixed, certain things are developed. Essential things are fixed. The juziyat are developed according to the movement and change of society. So you pray you're going to pray five times a day, there's no doubt about that. But the Prophet will say, for example, if your life is in danger, how do you pray? And at the same time, if you're drowning, it's wajib for you to pray. Even if you're drowning. But takbir is sufficient, and that's it, then you can die. It is wajib. You have to. You go to the fuqaha, what are they say? Even if you're drowning, you have to pray. It's time of prayer. Allahu Akbar, die. Well, if you have to. But you have to do something, right? So everything is categorized in this way. Everything is there. God hasn't taken off taklif from your shoulder in any situation. Every situation has an answer to that. You know, what do we do when you've been told to fast for 23 hours? Everything is there. Everything is there. How to fast, how to pray, how to do all of those things. Bab of ijtihad is open. Ulama will discuss and will continue to discuss until the coming of the imam. But essentially, coming back to what it is, politics, what is it? So remember, our libraries are destroyed. Omar destroyed them. The tradition says for 3 days the river was running black. Everything was destroyed. When all of these things are destroyed, obviously the Imam was feeling sorrow because of that. Because when you take his kalam and you compare it, sometimes you find your knowledge of philosophy actually explains the kalam better. He's a hakim, there's a difference. He's not a philosopher, he's a hakim. There's a difference between a hakim and an alim. The difference is that the alim can write hundreds of volumes, but the hakim takes an entire ocean and puts it into one word. One word of the imam and we're still discussing it. From 2002 when the United Nations made it apparent to now we are still just multiple different conversations. What does it mean when the imam says your brother in faith or you're equal in humanity? Have you ever looked at the entire letter that he writes to Malik al-Ashtar? And we'll discuss it because that is exactly what communities need. Discussion on that. So the next 45 minutes dictates for us. I'm moving on to that slowly. And I'm going to take those things which are relevant for today. But the fact of the matter is that the Emir is phenomenal stuff. Phenomenal stuff is how to rule. He's taking psychology. He's looking at things of philosophy. He's looking at ethics. He's looking at virtue. He's looking at politics. And he brings them all together in such a way. And the wording which he uses is phenomenal as well. Because remember, in modern day philosophy, there's a very big impact of words today, semantic meanings of words. You go back to the 20th century, you see philosophers discussing words. Imam uses words in such a way, it's as if those words were created for the Imam. He's the Imam of the Kalam as well, as they say. He's the Imam of all of this. These words, they flow. And each word has a reality as well. On a metaphysical level, each word has a reality. You go back to what the Kabbalists say, if you go back to what Jews say, each word has an angel. Each word has a muakkil. And the Imam is controlling all of it. The way that he uses the words is like music. It's the way that he's balanced. If you take those words even, and if you were to look at the numerical value of them, it's phenomenal. We've forgotten all of that. We've forgotten that culture of ours. You know, go to Najaf today, look at the shrine of the Emir. It is based by Sheikh Baha'i, built it on algorithms. You look at it, if you were to take to some of that, it comes and equates to certain musical tones as well. You look at the room, you look at the way that everything's designed, we forget all of these things because we don't study it anymore. We don't study all of these anymore. But it was there. The use of geometry, the use of mathematics, ulama would be taught of that because the purpose of knowledge in those days was to unfold reality, to understand the haqqaiq al-ashiyah. And today we are not going to understand haqqaiq al-ashiyah, but we're going towards, from tawheed, we're going towards multiplicity. We're going into kathra. And that's one of the biggest downfalls as well of modern day education that we find within our universities, because it doesn't teach people how to get to reality. It scatters things, but it doesn't fold things back and take it into unity again. Now remember, Mullah Sadr's philosophy of unity and multiplicity is exceptionally important when it comes to education. But anyhow, coming back, what is politics? Because we're going to need this, definitions of that. Politics, basically, Greeks have defined it like this. It is relating for, in, how, everything that relates to citizenship, citizens. On one level, that's politics. You're looking at politics on a macro level. There's also politics, which you'll find within the household as well. And this is where three definitions need to come forward. Politics is a common decision which affects a group of people. Now, that comes into family as well. Secondly, the power of one person or a group of people to affect the behavior of other people. Second. And thirdly, if you look at the idea of politics, it also fits under the mold of governance. And what is governance, essentially? Governance, according to Plato, is steering a society in a particular direction. Do we have a model of governance, even in the modern day? Because again, communities and societies are based upon these. We have multiple models, but I'm going to just mention three very quickly because they're relevant. In the occultation of the Imam, the first model of governance which comes forward is by Sheikh Dusi. Sheikh Dusi says that until Imam Ma'sum, this religion is not allowed to establish a government. Firstly, Sheikh Taifa. First movement is that you're not allowed to establish. He says that until Imam Ma'sum, you can't do that. So 20th century, all the different movements, if Sheikh Taifa was allowed, according to his philosophy, it's not allowed. Second is Ayatollah Naini's. Ayatollah Naini's is, he brings together democracy and the role of the ulama. And this is where the entire discussion on Wulayat al-Faqih starts off, really, with Ayatollah Naini. He's in between. The third argument really is Khomeini's argument, which is on the other side, which then he believes, no, there's two things that comes into play. One is the wilaya, or the guardianship of the jurist, and the other thing is the ability for that jurist to rule. So you have three different opinions. Each one of them have multiple different understandings as well. Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, for example, today discusses wilayat of fiqh in and of itself, the primacy of the fiqh over any one person, over any one jurist. That's another philosophy. And then multiple ones. The only reason I'm mentioning this is to tell you that actually there is a huge different understanding of that from Sheikh Dusi's, that no, you're not allowed to engage until the Imam Ma'sum comes along. Not allowed to establish a government, that is. To, for example, the idea of Ayatollah Naini, which is a marriage between the ulama and society. And that was something which has been predominant. You go back to the time of the Safavids were rulers. Sheikh Bahai, Mir Damad, most of these guys lived in partnership with the governments and interacted with the governments for the betterment of the people. Shia ulama have been involved within or been interacting with. And you go back to the time of Ali ibn Yaktin, in the time of Harun and Ma'mun and these people, you found that the Imam did appoint certain people and gave them the autonomy to interact with the government for the benefit of the society and communities, for example, and a discussion on politics. Finally, you have the concept of Wulayat al-Faqih. And again, philosophically, one would argue, or from a Western standpoint, you would argue that that's based upon Plato's philosopher king. The idea that one man is enlightened, one man has knowledge, one man is continuously developing love of knowledge. A person who is really the most apt from all of society to be able to govern. And again, what was Ayatollah Khomeini's principles originally when he first started? If you look at the change in the last 30 years, there's been an evolution of his ideas as well. The idea that the ulama were only to be guardians over the law, were not to be interacting within the government, slowly wanted to pull out of the ulama. And again, it's evolved and has to. Everything has to evolve. Nothing can be stagnant in a pragmatic society, pragmatic community. Our discussion is not on that, nor is it on Wulayat al-Faqih or otherwise. What is right, what is wrong, that's not our discussion. Ulama have discussed it, and they gain these principles from the imams. And this is what we're going to look at. Where do these principles come in? How do they apply? And what do they work? I want to mention one statement of Amir al-Mu'mineen, though. Having looked at the entire Nahj and going through everything, there are four things that come out as to why the imam administers a state. What is the purpose of a community? What are the foundations, the rukun or the arkan of a community? Four things. First thing, the primacy is this, that the purpose of these things, or the state or the community, is for the sake of security and peace. That is the first thing. Why? Because if you look at most of our philosophers who have interpreted the term of the imam, or gone into the imam, done commentaries on the words of the imam, one of them is Farabi. Farabi's political philosophy is extremely important because it's the head, you could say, of all the other philosophies, including Jewish understanding upon political philosophy. So Moses ben Maimonides is an authority within the Jewish world of political philosophy, and he takes his teachings from Ibn Sina and Farabi. Here Farabi basically says that the purpose of humanity is to go to its happiness and perfection. And this is exactly what our imams teach us as well, the idea of happiness, the idea of perfection. And here he says that without a system or state of politics, there is no way forward that you can go there, because remember one thing, we are affected by the climate around us. You could be as big a darwish as you want, but believe me, if you're in chains, or if your food is deprived of you, if you don't have the peace of mind, what happens? You know, even up to the battlefield, you know, the imam was once asked, he says that, tell me, when do you enjoy the battlefield? When is it enjoyable? He says, under three conditions. He says, what is it? When I know that my family is protected. When we're not thirsty. Right? All of these things he mentions. The reason why he mentions them is in relation to Sayyid al-Shuhada, because Sayyid al-Shuhada comes and says, look, my family are here. It's hot. I'm thirsty. I don't have peace of mind when it comes to my children. So everything has a particular climate. Everything has an atmosphere. And here Farabi says, and this is, again, in line with the words of the imam, is the fact that you need governance. You need a state, you need a community. And the first pillar of that is peace and security. What is the actual purpose of an Islamic state or a government? To give peace and security to its people. If that's not coming through, then there's a very big problem there. So the first thing is peace and security. The second one, funnily enough, is actually economic development. It is important to be economically, in terms of commerce and otherwise, be developed. It's actually important. A lot of times we underpin this. You'll see the imam's justice. The imam's justice is not a social system, by the way. Socialist system, sorry. It is a social system, but it's not a socialist system. He's not a Marxist. Imam does not say to make sure that the rich and the poor are equal. He doesn't ever say that. He doesn't say take the wealth away. We'll look at it in a minute. I'm going to go into a lot of detail, but before we do that, we just get these principles on the table. Third thing is social justice. And social justice, you looked at some of it last week, but I'm going to go into slightly more detail. I'm going to look at five different stages of justice. What does the imam talk about justice? The fourth thing, which is extremely important that the imam is doing, the concept of a community or a state, or even a family is what? Let's say, for example, we as families, husband and wife, what is important for you to do? The pillar of family is that you develop virtue. You develop virtue. You develop virtue within one another, and you develop virtue within your children. Why is virtue important? One of the pillars, the four pillars of a state, imam mentions one of them is virtue. And he does it. There's not one place where he says this. This is a gathering of all of the different sermons that he's saying. Why is virtue important? If you go back, you understand that virtue comes from ethics. Why is ethics important? Because the Prophet, in many of his traditions, has said, and you know that, the purpose of appointment of the Prophet was what? The makarim al-akhlaq, right? Akhlaq is important. Therefore, the pillar of akhlaq is virtue. What is virtue? Virtue is something which is universal to all human beings. It is a perennial wisdom. It is a perennial code. Today, when we talk about subjective ethics within the Western world, it's important to bear in mind that subjective ethics really doesn't solve any issues whatsoever. It actually creates issues. Why? Because if you look at it, there's two models in the Western world that we've used as in terms of ethics. One is consequentialism and the other one is deontological. Both of which would lead to the rise of Hitler, which it has done. Ethical foundations that the imam teaches is one based upon virtue. And virtue is a common language amongst everyone. So when he talks about the fact that either your brother in faith or humanity, that humanity is based upon virtue. I'll give you an example. Whether you're Christian, Jew, Muslim or atheist, whoever you be, there's an inert virtue inside of you that tells you that compassion is a good thing. It does, isn't it, right? Everyone believes in compassion. Why? Because it's a virtue which is primordial, something which is innate. To give is a good thing. To help people is a good thing. If the old lady is falling down, to help across the road is a good thing. It doesn't matter who you are. And one of the biggest arguments is an atheist as well. They say, well, we're very moral. According to which yardstick? According to the religious yardstick? Even your morality is based upon a Judaic Christian, if you're Western, or if you're Eastern, like Abu Bakr Rabi, who was another philosopher within Spain, who was an atheist. And look at the tolerance, by the way. Today, if a person in Al-Azhar says, "I'm an atheist," he wouldn't survive more than 30 seconds getting out the door. And you find that in those days, 1,000 years ago, there was the likes of Abu Bakr al-Radi, who was atheists, who would discuss Shia Sunni scholars, and they said, "Fine, you can be whatever you want to be. You know what? We're lovers of knowledge. We want to know what your argument is." There was no fundamentalism within academia. And this is the true meaning then. Today, if you look at it, we're killing each other on the basis of theology. You go back 1,000 years ago, where Sheikh Mufid was sitting down with the Mu'tazili and discussing things with the Mu'tazili. He would go to school. In those days, it was open. You would go to three different types of schools. If you were living in Baghdad 1,100 years ago, you would go to three schools. You would go to a Shia theological school, then you would go to a Mu'tazili school, then you would go to an Ash'ari school. And each one of these schools were open for each one of the individuals, whether you were Sunni or Shia. The purpose of which was that they understood that through understanding different perspectives can you only truly understand your own perspective. How old do you know Sunni fiqh? How old does a Sunni know Sunni fiqh? How old does a Maliki know what, for example, Qadi Abu Yusuf said? People don't even know who Qadi Abu Yusuf is. It's important to understand. Why? Qadi Abu Yusuf, by the way, is the person who actually expounds Abu Hanifa's fiqh. Abu Hanifa himself didn't actually expound it. He has 17 in all hadith that he sees as sahih. From 17 hadith, you cannot have an entire corpus of fiqh. This is why one of the big arguments is that you find that Shaybani and Qadi Abu Yusuf, for example, are the ones who expounded this fiqh. Abu Hanif actually doesn't have his own. But anyhow, that's a different discussion for a different day. Fact is really coming back again. Idea of virtue. And the Imam, you'll see through the entire last chapter, if you break it into three parts, the aqwal of the Imam is for what purpose? Is because he's breaking down virtue. The perfection of human beings lies within virtue. Remember, what was the purpose of the Prophet? Makaram al-akhlaq, right? Go back to what Aristotle says. Man is haywan al-natiq bil-irada. He is a rational animal. What differentiates man from an animal is his rational faculty. The perfection of your rational faculty can only come when your virtues are perfected. See, it's all a chain, it comes back again. What is the purpose of family truly? Husband and wife help one another, children help one another through the teachings of the Imam to perfect their virtues. And you'll see when it comes to family, we'll look at it, I've got it written. What does the Imam say you should be looking in a spouse? And it's phenomenal, though. In three lines, he just covers it. Bang, it's a dirt, dirt, dirt. There you go. Guys, this is what you should be looking in a woman. If you don't have that, this is the outcome. This is the outcome. And believe me, a lot of times you think to yourself, is this really the outcome? Now in practical life, after numbers of years looking at marital issues and stuff, you've seen the patterns and you can see what the Imam is saying, the patterns are there. What does the Imam say? You should marry race... No, it doesn't say that. It says, look, there's three things. Primacy essentially is taqwa. And we'll discuss it in a minute, why taqwa. And he looks at it. You marry somebody for their beauty, if you marry somebody... He gives you the answer. He says, this will happen and this will happen. He looks at the psyche of men as well. Looks at the psyche of men, he looks at the psyche of women. You marry a man with a particular psyche, this will happen. You look at this will happen. And so this is why it's a book which requires a lot of time, it requires a lot of effort, and that's just the introduction, and I've gone 33 minutes into it. And honestly, I was thinking that, look, I've got a lot of stuff to say, not for me as per se, because we haven't even touched, this is just the icing on the cake. You know, after looking at that, I wish we had 10 lectures to go through it systematically. It's not an easy book. Because you can pull in every resource. It's not something only for Shia as well. Believe me, if we were to open this up to Sunni or other people, they would definitely come if they understood what is there to be had. You know, people are impressed with Amir al-Mu'mineen, and I say this with complete confidence. I saw last month only, I saw the Church of Scotland quoting Amir al-Mu'mineen in the same seminar as Nicola Sturgeon was quoting Amir al-Mu'mineen. I was there because I was also speaking after that, and I thought, every single quote these guys are taking, what am I going to say? At the same time, you found Anthony Nolan's or the blood transfusion lot, they quoted Amir al-Mu'mineen. And I thought, look, people are quoting Amir al-Mu'mineen. The speech is online, I can give you the link. It's an hour and a half program. But the fact is, every other person is quoting Amir al-Mu'mineen from Business Glasgow or Scotland, quoting Amir al-Mu'mineen. I'm thinking, now it's my turn to come up. They've already given five different hadith of Amir al-Mu'mineen. What am I going to give, which is new? And each one of them are fascinated by Amir al-Mu'mineen. as I say, antithetical qualities that the Imam has. You don't find that within human beings. You find opposing qualities which are found within the Imam that nobody else has. He was what? He was the best leader. He was the best husband. He was the best father. He was the best when it came to health and fitness. He was look at it, everything. Everything the Imam is there. You don't find that. He was the best in everything. And that's why we call him the perfect man. If you want to follow someone who's the best. Don't compromise. You know, I still remember today, Rajiv Gandhi, right? Rajiv Gandhi was the Prime Minister of India. A friend of mine went to Rajiv Gandhi and they said, "You've got the letter of Amir al-Mu'mineen to Malik al-Ashtar in your drawing room. What's the purpose of that? Why don't you put it outside?" He says, "Because every morning when I wake up, when I read this letter, Imam talks to me how to govern." And you find he was a very successful prime minister, that's why they killed him. Successful people, good people, you kill. Right? I'm not saying you killed them, but that's what happens. You go back to Islamic history in the time of the Umayyads. Which khalifas were killed? Those people who are doing something. Muawiyah II, by the way, Yazid's son, didn't last for more than 6 months. They killed him because... And the other one, Umar ibn Abdulaziz. In 4 years, they killed him. Why? Because through Zayd, the Imam was telling Zayd what to tell him to do what? To bring equality and justice. There are three things that Umar ibn Abdulaziz did that led to his death. And it was all to do with the justice of the Imam. Because he was taking lessons from the students of the Imam who was feeding him and it was leading to justice. Umayyads didn't like that. That tells us also that interacting within a political system is not wrong. If you know that you're going to make a difference. If it's not detrimental to Islam. And we've been told to interact, but cleverly though. Be intelligent about it. And again, the fatawas, you can go and look at your marja. At the moment, all of the maraj and najaf have different opinions. From Ayatollah Sistani, who says that, yes, you can advise. To Sheikh Fayyad, who says you can be a minister. You have multiple... But the fact of the matter is that we've been told to make a difference. The fact is that we've been told to... You remember, it is not just about us, right? If you live in London, for example, and the Imam teaches this to... You'll see this in a minute when we discuss it. Imam teaches this to Malik al-Ashtar. When you live in an ummah, the Imam says, look, you're going to have people who are going to be there, who are going to be of your faith and not going to be of your faith. So we're in one room now, regardless of whether you're from Yemen, or you're from Iraq, or you're from Lebanon or any other place. If something happens to this room, all of us are affected. All of us are. If, for example, this plant falls, it's going to disrupt my discussion, all of us are going to run to grab it, regardless of which country you're from. In the same way, when you live in London, regardless of whether you're Jew, Muslim or Christian, the concept of the Prophet was teaching in Medina, when he broke Medina into six parts, and he gave autonomy to every religion, and he allowed them to judge and rule, and he signed a covenant, is very important. Imam, throughout entire literature at the moment, if you look at it, he's looking towards covenants. And that's important. There's academic work being done at the moment on the issue of covenants. The former chief rabbi has spoken on it. The former archbishop has spoken on the idea of covenants. The pope has spoken on covenants. At the moment, we are working on the idea of covenants. The last 2 years I've been involved in this whole idea. We brought forward Amir al-Mu'mineen's stuff. Because there are only two places or three places within history you find mediation, and Imam uses the idea of covenants to be able to broker peace as well. You know, so there's an idea at the moment in the last 2 years that's developed that the United Nations is not sufficiently apt to be able to bring peace. Because mediation, basically, give you the crux of it, the reason why is because it fits into what the Imam is saying. And I'm putting it into a modern day context. United Nations, the purpose of its development when it was formed firstly in Westminster Hall, in the Methodist Hall in Westminster, was for what? The idea that we wouldn't have conflict again, right? Conflict resolution at the moment means what? Two parties are fighting, let's say, a third party comes in and it mediates. Generally what happens is that somebody has to give something up. We've come to the conclusion that giving something up means like a spring. the other party, whoever's given it up, or both parties who have given something up, feel oppressed. You find in the next 10 years they make the same mistakes or the same problems happen. What is the best way we came? This is the world leaders now coming to a conclusion. I can give you all the names of them as well. From King Abdullah of Jordan onwards, each one of them have said the only way we can come to a solution is through covenants. Who's the first person to use covenants? Amir al-Mu'mineen is. In fact, before that, Rasulullah is. The covenants that he signs with Jews, Christians, with the kings. There's an entire book now that's been translated within English by a guy called Professor Morrow, who deals with all the covenants of Rasulullah that he had. Amir al-Mu'mineen takes it and he basically develops, obviously the Imam would, expands it to the modern day context as well. Amir al-Mu'mineen is looking at covenants on a family level, on a community level, and on a state level. But again, it requires another discussion of what covenants is. Now, let me just give you a definition. You have two things. You have something which is known as an aqd, a contract, which is a bilateral contract. Marriage starts off as an aqd. Remember, bilateral contract, but it develops into a covenant. Aqd has two types. Or when we talk about the idea of a mithaq, which the Quran talks about, has two realities to it. One is a contract, one is a covenant. We want our marriages to be covenantal. What is a contract? A contract can be terminated when two people's needs are not being fulfilled or two people's expectations are not being fulfilled. Covenant starts off at the point where there's difficulty. Covenant is not a contract. It is a moral obligation upon two or more people to be there for one another in moments when it gets bad. That's what covenants are. And this is what the Imam is teaching us. This is why he goes to Malik al-Ashtar. Remember your covenant when you go to Egypt. Your covenant over the people. It's not a contract. You can't just terminate it. It's a covenant. And that means that you are then morally responsible for Jews, Christians, Muslim, atheists, whoever that may be. If you've taken the governance, if you've taken the leadership role, you are responsible covenantally towards them. Right? We see within the Old Testament there are two covenants. And this is why Rabbi Sacks, well, somebody asked him once, he said, are you Jews not elitist? He says, no. Because primacy was the covenant of Noah, which was for all of humanity. The Mosaic covenant was based upon the guardianship of law. Guardianship of law doesn't make us superior, it means that we are the custodians of the law. And that was his answer, and it was quite a good answer, really. In terms of the fact that primacy is with humanity. We are bound as human beings to one another. And here the famous statement of the Imam portrays that. Your brother in faith or your equal in humanity. That is a covenantal relationship that you have to one another. Imam is teaching pluralism in a time where religious people don't do that. Go to any development of any community or society. Why is it that Europe was in the Dark Ages when Islam was formed? Why was it? Why was it the fact that all of these libraries were in Alexandria, not in Europe? You ever thought about that? Europe was in the Dark Ages. The only reason Europe has knowledge today, the only reason that Europe understands philosophy and the entire 16th, 17th century from Enlightenment all the way down to modernism and postmodernism, only reason why it could have taken place is because of Islamic philosophers converting and translating Greek and other philosophies back through Europe. If you go today, when you go on your third or fourth honeymoon to Venice, just remember one thing, don't go as a honeymoon, but look around and see. Artifacts there are all Islamic. You go to the Iberian Peninsula, go there. Go to Cordoba, go to other places like that. Go to Spain, go to Portugal, it's all Islamic, my friends. This is where Europe became Europe. Islam humanized Europe. It doesn't tell you that. If you go to any university and you'll see that within some of the older literatures. Why? Because Thomas Aquinas and the likes of Thomas Aquinas only became Thomas Aquinas because of the fact that they copied and pasted Ibn Sina. The mistake that Ibn Sina makes in some of his charts is exactly the same mistake Thomas Aquinas is making. Either he was thinking on the same likes as Ibn Sina, or he was carbon copying it. Allah knows best. Fact is, Europe owes a great debt. But let me ask you the question, why is it that Europe got to a state whereby things had to be smuggled out of Europe? Because of the rise of Wahhabism within Christianity. 5th and 6th century saw the likes of Justinian, who was a complete Wahhabi. And he said the same thing. The Kitab of Allah is sufficient for us. Led to the banning of everything else. Imam doesn't say that. Imam says without Ahlul Bayt, you can't understand the Quran. And Ahlul Bayt have always said, Hikmah is the lost camel of the believer. Wherever he finds the Hikmah, go grab it. Grab Hikmah from wherever you can find it. Because it explains to you. It opens your mind up. You truly begin to understand the words of the Imam. Remember the hadith in Usul al-Kafi. You can't understand the kalam of the Imam. Only the angels can, and the Anbiya can, and those people who have been tested can. So it's not easy for everybody just to understand. You think we can understand it, just open up a book and start reading it. No, it's multi-layered. Why is it today that new fatawa are coming forward? Because it gives us a new dimension. We begin to understand a new dimension. And that's important. So anyhow, it's coming back very fast, I think. You gave me 45 minutes. My 45 minutes is up. I'm going to take 5 minutes then before, just if you allow me to, and then we'll hit a break. Unfortunately, I've just been able to cover 20% of what I wanted to cover in the first session. But we were talking on individual virtues. It's extremely important for us to cultivate that individual virtues. Final point is this. You know when you talk about justice, right? Adl. And you looked at it last week. Now, I don't know what you guys said last week, but what I will do is I'm just going to expand on it. I'm hoping that this wasn't covered, so I'm going to cover it. Justice in the Islamic terminology is actually, adl actually means justice and fairness. It's not just justice in and of itself. Justice means putting a rightful thing in its rightful place. Fairness, again, Imam points towards that. And the third thing he points towards, which you don't find within the Western justice system, is compassion. Imam looks for compassion. Imam is compassionate. And that's something you don't find. You don't go to a court of law today and there's a compassion. You don't find compassion. There's three things which come forward: justice, fairness, and compassion. Imam breaks down, or what I'm getting from what the Imam breaks down is, from what I'm getting when I look at the Nahj, there are five things which are coming in terms of justice. Imam gives formal justice. Imam gives, you could say, retributive justice. Imam gives compensatory justice. Imam gives transactional justice. And Imam gives distributive justice, right? That's important. Imam's justice is a distribution of fairness. Imam doesn't turn around and say, millionaire, give me your money, and we're going to equal you out with the guy who's poor. He doesn't say that. It's based upon effort, distribution, fairness. Fairness does not mean a social system. Fairness doesn't mean a capital system either. Capitalist system. Imam takes the middle ground. It's where, if we were to implement the laws of the Imam, we could improve our economy, believe me. Today, the Western solution would be going back to Amir al-Mu'mineen and the way that he governed. So, one type of justice is this distributive justice, which we're looking at, that comes time and time again, which is based upon fairness. And the highest term that seems to be used is the rights of citizens. Understand the right of citizens, understand the rights of one another. To be just requires you to understand, otherwise you don't know where you're violating the rights. It is not comparative, it is not egalitarian. Amir al-Mu'mineen doesn't go for a comparative egalitarian idea. What he does is he looks at rights, and he looks at fairness. And again, that's important. Fairness, so it's very pragmatic. When you look at it, it's a very pragmatic moving system. And truly it's intellectual. Honestly speaking, it's intellect, because from the root, this change that there's a movement there, which is there. So again, the example would be, he's making and streamlining efficiency, and he's trying to get the best output for the people. So when we said that the purpose of a state was fourfold: security and peace, economic development, social justice, and individual virtue, on the basis of peace and security, he is optimizing the best. In terms of economic development, he's optimizing again. At the same time, social justice is optimizing. And in terms of individual virtue, he's optimizing. So therefore, he's doing two things. He's improving the personal situation of people, from families to society to communities. And at the same time, he's looking at the common good of people. It's a multi-layered approach. It's immensely, somebody could do a PhD on this. I wish someone did do a PhD on this. You have a top-down and a bottom-up approach. You have two models which are coming into play. The final thing I'm going to say before I conclude this session, because I've taken the 5 minutes as well. In fact, I'm looking at the time, I've got like 40 seconds. 40 seconds, I would say this, that one of the things that the Imam does is really, you look at four points that come forward from the Nahj. Education, and he says, understand the rights of education. Prosperity, because he wants us to be prosperous. Good rulership and welfare system. All of these things are important. And again, it resonates with communities, and it resonates with families, and it resonates with states and it resonates with the political system. It goes from a micro to a macro level. And I think that's extremely important to bear in mind. So what I'll do is I'm going to close up shop for now, give you guys a 10-minute break. You can wake yourself up. Apologize if it's been boring or too complex. And inshallah, we'll continue in 10 minutes.